Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the Clintons' associations with the shadow government, or what is known as the deep state. Joining me now will be Professor Lawrence Shope in Hawaii. Professor Shope is a historian who has been researching the background and agendas of the Council on Foreign Relations for 40 years. He has taught history, social science, and international relations at the University of Illinois, San Francisco State University, and other institutions. For 50 years, Dr. Shope has been active in human rights struggles, protesting the Vietnam War, marching with Martin Luther King, and participating in the Union Movement. He holds degrees from California State University and a doctorate from Northwestern University. He is the author of 5 books, his most recent being Wall Street's Think Tank, The Council on Foreign Relations and the Empire of Neoliberal Geopolitics. His website is Lawrence Shope, shoup.com. My guest is on the phone now, Professor Lawrence Shope. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be here.
Thank you. You have likely read about Madeleine Albright, Bill Clinton's former ambassador to the UN and later Secretary of State, appearing alongside Hillary Clinton during his presidential campaign in New Hampshire. She also bragged during the last Democratic debate that Henry Kissinger supports her. And Albright is currently a board director member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it Albright who more or less sponsored Bill Clinton's membership to the Council on Foreign Relations earlier?
Yes, that's right, and in the 1980s.
And wasn't it that while he was still governor of Arkansas?
Yes, that's right. He was governor of Arkansas. He was planning to run for the presidency, and of course, Madeleine Albright was an activist in the Democratic Party and also a longtime member of the Council on Foreign Relations even then. And she sponsored him to get into the Council on Foreign Relations, which is, of course, a membership organization and a think tank both.
He also was a member of the Trilateral Commission, and once Bill Clinton got into the White House, many of his appointees were members of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. So
yeah,
the Clintons have a deep connection with the powerful strategic and policy think tanks that go back to when he was a relatively nickel-and-dime governor of a state that had a horrible record in health care, education, and poverty reduction compared to the rest of the nation. And it's believed by many that the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission are part of what has been called the shadow government, or the deep state, to use Peter Dale Scott's term, a network that influences American politics and yet is unelected and not accountable by the rule of law that would otherwise apply to the U.S. government and federal departments and agencies. So first, very briefly, list the most important entities that make up the shadow government, and then please take your time and speak about the Clintons' deep association with this network and the main power players who serve as the puppet masters of the government's policies and bills.
Yeah, I think the most important one by far, and there isn't really one that's any close to the importance of the Council on Foreign Relations. It's really the center of a vast network, and I document that in my book, Wall Street's Think Tank, which just came out late last year. It's very well documented. I have 798 footnotes from in the book that covers all the annual reports of the Council on Foreign Relations, etc., to document all the details. It's a 5,000-member organization that plans strategic policy behind the scenes. Now, there are other think tanks, but they all seem to be interconnected with, the most important ones at least, seem to be interconnected with the Council on Foreign Relations, such as the Brookings Institute or the American Assembly or the Atlantic Council. These are all interconnected, very heavily interlocked with the Council on Foreign Relations. Of course, the Trilateral Commission is the international equivalent of the Council on Foreign Relations. It brings together Western European, North American, and Asian leaders into a dialogue and also does planning. The Council does planning through its think tank part of its organization, and it does idea dissemination through its magazine called Foreign Affairs, which is called the Bible of Foreign Policy Thinking. And they also have, study groups that put out ideas that then get disseminated in various ways through books, articles, testimony before Congress. They also are very often on television programs, PBS and so on, and they don't necessarily identify the person that's being that's speaking as a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. They say, this is a Harvard professor, or this is a Washington Post journalist, or this is a New York Times reporter. But actually, they're members of the Council on Foreign Relations, so they subscribe to the worldview, which I cover in my book, Neoliberal Geopolitics. So that is free market capitalism for the of the capitalist, by the capitalist, for the capitalist, and geopolitics, world struggle for power. So the Council goes back all the way to the First World War. It's been very powerful for a long time. And the Clintons, like you mentioned, Bill became a member in the 1980s. And it's interesting that Hillary never became a member because, as you also pointed out, and very accurately, they work as a team. So when Bill got to be the Attorney General of Arkansas, then the power structure of Arkansas, as exemplified by the Rose Firm and Walmart and Tyson Foods and the Stevens Investment Firm, they recognized that Hillary was an up-and-coming lawyer, and she became part of the Rose Law Firm, which is the most powerful law firm in Arkansas and one of the most powerful in the country. And then when Bill got elected governor, right away, Hillary became the first law partner, female law partner, of the Rose Law Firm. So they always work in a tandem, trying to do influence peddling, and you can give an example with the Tyson Foods. Hillary benefited greatly by her connection with Tyson Foods. She was able to speculate on cattle futures in the 1970s. She took $1,000 and turned it into $100,000 by speculation in close coordination with Tyson Foods, which was buying cattle, of course, so knew how the cattle futures might go. So there was a corruption involved there. And then, of course, Tyson wanted to also pollute the waterways of Arkansas, and Bill Clinton as governor allowed them to do so by having weak regulations, so they were able to throw chicken sludge waste into the Arkansas's waterways, environmental disaster, and the town of Forest Green came down, a lot of the people came down with chronic dysentery, this was in the 1980s, because of the connection of the Clintons to the Tyson food empire. So this is the kind of influence peddling and self-serving kind of things that the Clintons have done. We could go on and talk about Bilderbergers. That's an important international organization based mostly in Europe, but their U.S. connection is the Council on Foreign Relations. 92% of the Bilderbergers from the United States are members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Bill started attending Bilderberger meetings in 1991, and Hillary began to go to Bilderberger meetings in 1997. So that they've had a connection with this other international organization that's very powerful behind the scenes.
Okay, Larry, I just want you to focus on a moment, if you will, please.
Yeah.
On giving us the background of the Clintons in more detail, because most people are only looking at what they see in the latest appearance on television, the latest ad. They don't know that there was a whole history here. And I'm going to throw several topics at you.
Okay.
And if you have knowledge of any of these, please give us the background. Here
okay.
are the topics, all right? I'm just going to go. Don't answer until I give you all the topics, all right?
All right.
Bill Clinton's misdeeds as governor of the state. Hillary Clinton's Rose Law Firm and Webb Hubble, who ran the law firm, and the dirty deals alleged by Hubble when he got the first loan for over $2.5 million in the state of Arkansas from the newly developed Arkansas Development Corporation, which he was the architect of, and he was the one who sold it to the people of Arkansas through the state legislature, and then he was the one who got the first loan and never paid a penny back. And all that you know about Hubble, because he was later taken to the Justice Department to be third in line to the top person in the Justice Department. Also, the associations that Bill Clinton had with the Dan Lassiter, who was convicted and sent to jail, the drug dealing, which at one time more drugs were entering the United States through MENA, Arkansas, this tiny little Arkansas airport than any other place in the United States, and yet no arrests were made. We later would have state troopers come forward and make the claim, the allegation, that they personally took envelopes filled with cash to the Clinton's office, including members of his personal bodyguard, who were state police. How he ran the state of Arkansas as if it were his domain. He was very similar to Huey Long in that of Louisiana in that sense. And how, if you were on his side, the advantages that came your way, if you spoke against him, big disadvantages. And some of the more notorious situations that occurred, and even investigators with the state police, investigators with the attorney general's office, who were told to step down or stop major investigations that would have implicated the Clintons. So what you know about the Clintons now, and that there's substantial proof of, I'd like for you to share that with us so we understand where this couple came from. Right now we just see them on red carpets, private jets, $500,000 lecture fees worth over $130 million. Their foundation has $2 billion. They meet the heads of the world. The celebrities love them. The American public loves them. And nobody asks about their background. Yeah. I'd like for you to address that, please.
Well, unfortunately, my expertise is more in the Council on Foreign Relations and the relationship of the Clintons to that power structure rather than these more detailed things about the drug deals. I've heard about them, but I can't really speak to having a lot of knowledge about that. I can go back to Bill Clinton's very early career. That is, when he was at Georgetown University, he took a class with Carol Quigley, who's an expert on the Anglo-American ruling class, and learned a lot from Carol Quigley about that, and wanted to join that, and was able to get to be a Rhodes Scholar in Oxford, where he began to interact with leading figures, including Strub Talbot, who was his roommate, and was another person that helped him get into the Council on Foreign Relations. So he goes way back to the 1960s, being interested in being connected to the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, etc. So his connections, and that's my expertise rather than these other aspects. And okay. You touched on, of course, the foundation. I think the foundation is something to look at, too, because I did a look. I looked very detailed. I wrote an article that's going to appear in Z Magazine in March about the Clintons, the Clinton Empire, the Clinton and the shadow government. And their foundation is a political front for them. That is, 16 out of the 31 people that they mention on their own website as being the leaders of the foundation, directors or other top leaders, leadership group, 16 of the 31 are political operatives for Clinton. And this is a pretty, that is, it's a slush fund where they bring in their political operatives to give them an easy job, lots of money, and then they drop out when there's a campaign to be run. The Clintons have been involved, of course, in many campaigns over the years. We're talking Bill ran about 14 times, and Hillary's run about 4 times. So they need these political operatives that are standing by ready to help them. Hillary Clinton's top fundraiser right now worked for the Clinton Foundation and compiled lots of lists of funding possibilities from the Clinton Foundation. And the, like I say, 16 of the 31 top people at the Clinton Foundation are these types of political fundraisers for the Clintons or political operatives who drop out to run the campaigns, help them with the campaigns. So I think there's a 501c3 violation there that is supposed to be a tax-deductible foundation. As you mentioned, they raised $2 billion, mostly from rich people and from governments who wanted to influence Hillary while she was Secretary of State. Various governments gave, 20 governments gave money to the Clinton Foundation while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. It's illegal, of course, to give money to political candidates by foreign governments, but you can give to the foundation and thereby influence the Secretary of State that way, and they did that. I think that was some of that was for influence purposes. So they raised very large sums of money from governments, from rich people, and then part of it is a political slush fund for themselves. And their other, of course, another one of their big ways of raising money is just raising money for campaigns. There's about $1 billion there. The Washington Post did a study that said $1 billion has been raised by Bill and Hillary Clinton for their political campaigns over the years, $2 billion for the foundation, and of course they do these speeches, and they, as you became very wealthy, worth $125-130 million according to celebrity net worth. This is a family that didn't have a vast amount of net worth when they started out, and so that indicates the influence peddling that goes on, and the fact that they're about getting rich, and they've been very successful at that.
It would almost appear that the Clintons were groomed for their entrance on the world stage well before Bill's 1992 presidential campaign. The fact alone that this pair was so scandal-ridden, with so many of their close associates and friends having been busted, were jailed for everything from drug running to money laundering to obstruction of justice and so much more without any major coverage by the national media, would suggest, at least to me, it's my opinion, that the Clintons were extremely well protected and supported by individuals or groups who have a great deal of use for them. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, this goes into some of the people that have supported them over the years. The Walton family, of course, is worth something like $120 billion, more money than almost half the U.S. population has in terms of its wealth. That's just a small family of five, six individuals. Christy Walton is one of Hillary Clinton's donors, big donors. George Soros, who's a vast billionaire, was a director of the Council on Foreign Relations for many years. He's given a lot of money to Clinton. Lynn D. Rothschild, who married one of the Rothschilds, the European Rothschild, she's another big supporter of Hillary Clinton. She's also given money to Hillary Clinton. She said the capitalists would be very happy to have Hillary Clinton, capitalists as represented by the Rothschilds of European royalty. Now she's an American citizen. She married a Rothschild of England and became a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She's donated a lot of money to the Clintons. So they get money from these rich people, and then, of course, they serve the rich people's interests once they get into office and serve themselves, of course, becoming wealthy at the same time. These people, in many respects, you've alluded to this, they're kind of above the law, you know, because they're so powerful, because they're so well-connected, that the law doesn't apply to them. So is there any investigation of the Clintons using their foundation as a slush fund for their political operatives, and that they have, they also have people that consult? Hillary's co-chair of her presidential campaign right now was a consultant to the foundation, gets a big salary for doing almost nothing, and now she's the co-chair of Clinton's presidential campaign. So this hasn't been investigated. They're above the law. They're not looking. No one's looking into the Clintons Foundation as a violation of 501c3 status. This happens all the time, of course. David Rockefeller, as I mentioned in my book, he bribed his vice president of Chase Bank, Chase Manhattan Bank, back in the 1970s, bribed a foreign official $50,000 cash in a briefcase. He mentions it in his memoirs. He writes about it in his memoirs, David Rockefeller's memoirs. He's not afraid of being prosecuted for bribing a foreign official, which is a felony. He's not worried about it. He's not going to be investigated. He's not going to be prosecuted. He's above the law. Similarly, Bush and Cheney, they admit to torture. They say, yes, we did torture. We had waterboarded. It's fine. They went on television. They wrote in their memoirs. Any investigation? No, torture's all right. Well, it's actually a felony. You can be executed for torture in the United States if someone investigates you and looks into it. Is there any looking into it? No, Obama said it's behind us. We don't want to look at it. This is a very bad precedent to allow some people to be above the law when we're supposed to be living in a country of laws.
The average American believes that a president has the power and authority to implement any change he or she wants. Yet behind the president are scores of other interests, and increasingly private corporate and financial interests. We saw throughout the Clinton and Obama presidencies where campaign promises were consistently broken, and the actual agendas eventually approved through the White House favored the wealthy, you mentioned the Waltons, and powerful private interests rather than the average American citizen. My fundamental problem with the Clintons is that you can't believe anything they say. This is a tag team that can't be trusted, and worse, it's a package deal. If you elect Hillary, you get Bill.
Exactly.
And since leaving office in 2000, I can't find a single noteworthy or praiseworthy project or activity that Bill or his foundation have accomplished. I've seen him showing up in Haiti, but let me take you to Haiti and introduce you to people who live in Haiti, activists and other people who say that the only thing that Clinton does when he comes to Haiti is bring a large retinue, and they make deals with those people that they put into office, the Clintons put into office, and so that private corporations are able to exploit the resources and the people of Haiti. So he is not loved by the people of Haiti. He has made all too much money for himself and his friends by using his prestige and his power to let people know the photo op is here. But the photo op should be the story, or should never be the story. It's what do you do behind that? I find a single truly great achievement is simply not in existence when it comes to Hillary Clinton. Tell me what she did when she was senator and secretary of state that was a benefit to the people. I can show you a lot of things she did as secretary of state, not the least of which she was one of the inspirations for invading Libya. Look at Libya then. Look at Libya today and see the difference. She created genocide in that country, and she wouldn't have done it if she didn't have the advice and support of her husband. And as far as accomplishing a great deal of damage, there's plenty of evidence. Yes, by leaving no worthy legacy of humanitarian accomplishments in public office, the Clintons and their foundation have generated immense wealth for themselves and their corporate friends by promoting a very un-American corporate free market agenda. She supports the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He was the major supporter of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization and CAFTA. And as a result, all of these were destabilizing to the American workplace, causing massive disruption and outsourcing of jobs to other countries, all of which has been profiteered by those that were there with their hands out. This raised the question regarding how much control does the shadow government have over executive and legislative policies in Washington, who wags whose tail, and if Hillary is so snuggled in bed with the shadow government, what might we expect of a Hillary presidency to be like, and what would the likely result after 4 years be? So take your time, because now you're going to pull back that curtain and show us the Council on Foreign Relations as it really is, based upon what they have supported. And by the way, weren't they one of the supporters of the war in Lebanon, the war in Syria?
Correct.
And
Iraq. The war in Iraq especially.
Yes.
The war in Syria also. But the idea behind neoliberal geopolitics is the Council on Foreign Relations as the main strategic planner behind the scenes, and their people are the ones that go into office. That is the Secretary of Treasury, the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, all of which are, under Obama, Council on Foreign Relations people. Part of my study, Wall Street's think tank, I show that 80% of the top officials since the Carter administration, the book covers from 1976 to 2014, 80% were Council on Foreign Relations members. So their strategic planning involves trying to open up the world, that is, destroy governments that aren't friendly to the United States, and destroy those and open them up so that free market capital can come in. So that's what's behind the war in Syria, for example. Assad has had a state-controlled system. They wanted to break the state control so that U.S. corporations and other multinational corporations affiliated and interlocked with the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and the trilateral, the international organizations that the worldwide transnational ruling class are prominent in. And they did that one in Iraq. And L. Paul Bremer was the one that came in once the United States broke the Saddam Hussein regime, put him his as dictator, and he instituted a neoliberal program there where you get rid of all the tariffs, you destroy the state ownership, and you bring in the U.S. corporations, including they tried to bring in, and it was they had a lot of difficulty because the Iraqi people resisted, bring in the U.S. oil companies to take over the oil fields. And they only have a partial success on that, but on the rest of it, they've had a very large success in making Iraq a neoliberal paradise for U.S. corporations. That's the whole idea, is to expand U.S. influence, economic influence abroad, political influence as well, of course, but economic influence so that the multinational corporations can make a lot of profit. And similarly, that TPP, now Hillary Clinton now is saying, oh, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I'm not really in favor of that. She's always been in favor of it. She is, now that she's running for office and there's someone opposing her that doesn't support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, then suddenly she's against it because she wants to be that fake populist that she's always tried to pretend to be. A fake populist, oh, I'm really for the people. That's all nonsense. That's not what she's really about. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a corporate power grab to take over various countries, including the United States, end sovereignty and turn end our sovereignty of our nation and turn it over to the corporations so they can rule things. So if for example, we want to pass a law limiting, oil drilling or something in our country, and some other country was involved in the oil drilling, some multinational from France or some other country, they can sue in court. The special court that's set up, run by the corporations, they can sue the local entity, whatever it is, in order to get some reparations. And so we'd have to pay if we were trying to do certain things which should be under our sovereignty. It's a corporate power grab. It's a giveaway to corporations. And that's just part of it. Of course, the other part is it makes it very easy for these corporations to go overseas to get cheap labor, cheap resources, and undermine our own economy here in this country. And that's what the Council on Foreign Relations has always been about, helping the capitalist class. It's one of my chapters, the first chapter of the book, Wall Street's Think Tank, is about the capitalist class and the Council on Foreign Relations, showing in great detail that this is an organization by and for the capitalist class. And so what they do is benefiting these big corporations. And so that's what the Council on Foreign Relations has been doing. They were behind the Iraq War. I have a whole chapter on the Iraq War showing that Council on Foreign Relations people and Council on Foreign Relations study groups were behind getting into the war. And the people that made the policy in the government, people like Condoleezza Rice or Colin Powell or Paul Wolfowitz or Dick Cheney, those are all members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and some of them have been directors of the Council on Foreign Relations. So they're the ones that got us into the war. I did a part of that chapter that shows that 85% of the decision makers to get into the Iraq War were Council on Foreign Relations people, and previous to that, there had been study groups in the Council on Foreign Relations saying that that would be a good idea. They even had a book came out in 2002 called Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq, a Council on Foreign Relations book written by a staff member, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. So they were totally behind that war, and it was a neoliberal geopolitical power grab, not just the neoliberal part I've already mentioned, that is getting the U.S. corporations to run the Iraq economy, but the geopolitical side of it was to get control over one of the main sources of oil in the world, Iraq, and then use that power to control indirectly other countries that might need that oil, such as China, Western Europe, Japan. So the United States has a lot of influence in Western Europe and Japan, but not so much over China. So getting the control over those oil fields, in fact, one of the articles in Foreign Affairs had a subtitle by the same guy that wrote the Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq, that same period, wrote the article, It's the Oil, Stupid. The article wasn't entitled that, but that was a subtitle of one of the sections of the article in Foreign Affairs magazine, the Council on Foreign Relations magazine, saying it's the oil, stupid. That is, the United States controlling that Middle Eastern oil, having bases in Iraq to control even Saudi Arabia if necessary, but especially the Iraqi oil, that this would also give U.S. geopolitical power worldwide. And so that's their worldview, neoliberal geopolitics, and it manifests itself in lots of different areas, these wars, but also the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the one they're planning now to do with Europe. There's also the acronym I'm spacing on right now, but it's the European version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership they're negotiating now with Europe.
During Hillary's tenure as Obama's Secretary of State, we witnessed coups staged in Honduras and Paraguay, the Arab Spring, and at least in Egypt, there is strong reason to believe the U.S. government was pulling various strings to bring a more compliant regime into power. There was a removal of Gaddafi in Libya and attempts to remove Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Although the U.S.-led fascist coup in Ukraine did not occur under Hillary's watch, she and her neocon friend and appointee, Victoria Nuland, had been planning this years earlier. When we look at these coups, in whose real interest was it to remove the existing governments? Surely none of them benefited the American people in any way, yet we can observe how certain large American multinational corporations and large banks benefited greatly. So do you feel it's fair to say that Hillary and her husband are in many respects simply ideological agents, political agents for the global interest of this shadow government, and everything else about making America great is just drama and theater?
That's absolutely correct. And it's even, I documented, I think, pretty well in a short piece, 4,000 words, that's going to appear in Z Magazine in March this year. So that is exactly the point I make in the article, and people can get it even on their website in another few more weeks.
What are some of the more egregious examples of what the Council on Foreign Relations has, through its many 5,000 different members, been able to put forth and sell to the American world community that turned out to be disastrous?
Well, I think the Iraq War is the prominent one, but there's a whole number of other things. Like, for example, the genetically modified organisms. The Council on Foreign Relations had a very large study group. It was about 60 people on it. Including, of course, the usual suspects, Monsanto and DuPont and other big corporations that have an interest in these GMOs. They did a study on how to best promote genetically modified organisms. I think genetically modified organisms are dangerous. They haven't been adequately studied. We shouldn't be having that in our food, and we should have it all labeled. So, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations, with its study group, which, of course, when they put a study group together, they bring in the vested interest, and then they bring in the professors who can disseminate, and they bring in the journalists who can also disseminate, and then they have they meet for over a period of time and then write up a report. So their report is available on their website, cfr.org. If you want to look up many of these things, you can get the annual report of the Council on Foreign Relations at cfr.org, and you can find out. It's a vast website. You can find lots of information, but the GMO is just one example. Then they also, the Special Operations Forces, they had a special report on Special Operations Forces, which are, secret attack forces that go into countries to assassinate people, to kidnap people. And it's being done on a very large scale. We're talking one figure said it was 70 different countries were subject to U.S. Special Operation Forces. They go in at the dead of night, not just in Afghanistan or Iraq, but all kinds of different countries, and take out some person and kill them or kidnap them to torture them, maybe if they need to. So they were finding ways to. They did a study on this so that they would find ways to better have the Special Operation Forces and better operate drones. They had also a study group on drones. Drones were coming under criticism because of many civilian casualties. So the Council on Foreign Relations thought, well, why don't we have a study group on drones, and we can whitewash drones to make them seem much more benign. So they came up with a whole study group. These are parts of my book, of course, where I go into this. And then another example, these are chapter 7. I have a number of case studies. In that chapter 7, I also talk about Bangladesh as an example of a neoliberal paradise for clothing manufacturers. Now, in Bangladesh, they have these foreign clothing manufacturers, or maybe locals that do subcontracts to clothing manufacturers like Walmart, which, of course, Hillary Clinton has a long connection with Walmart. She was a director, and she said at the time she's very proud of Walmart, etc. And so much for her woman, being for women. She's not for poor women. She's for rich women, because the poor women working at Walmart were making peanuts, minimum wage or very not much above minimum wage, while Hillary Clinton was very proud to be a director of Walmart and get learn corporate integrity, quote-unquote. She said, "I learned corporate integrity from Sam Walton, of Walmart. So she was a Walmart director for many years. Anyway, Walmart's one of those that operates in Bangladesh, and they pay the people there $37 a month. And if the people try to organize a union, they have thugs that are hired by the government or by the employers that take these people that are trying to organize a union and torture them and assassinate them. And then if people go out on strike or try to do a demonstration, then these same thugs, which are connected to the government, come around and beat them up, and the police does nothing, or maybe the police are the ones sometimes doing the beating up. And the people that are, of course, these corporations that are benefiting from the exploitation of the Bangladesh people under neoliberalism, those people are connected into the Council on Foreign Relations. They're members of the Council on Foreign Relations and directors of these corporations like Walmart and others, or they're corporate members of the council. I didn't mention that the council has, I mentioned this council has 5,000 members, but I didn't mention that it has about 150 corporate members. And of course, they're the usual ones you would expect, the big banks like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley, et cetera, at Citibank. And then also lots of other corporations like Caterpillar and Shell and Chevron and ExxonMobil. Those are the corporate members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and they benefit from this worldwide exploitation that goes on in many countries, such as Bangladesh, with their very ruthless exploitation of workers so that they can have cheap clothes come to the United States. And one of these people that runs one of the corporations that has is exploiting the Bangladeshi workers, one of their directors is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations that also is part of the Agape, a religious organization at Georgetown University that studies this problem and whitewashes it that way. So it goes into whitewashing, exploitation by some ethical studies that they do at this religious connection at Georgetown University that this Council on Foreign Relations person is involved in. And if there's investigations that need to be done, they put in Council on Foreign Relations people to be like George Mitchell, headed up a investigatory body that was appointed, of course, by these corporations to go and look at Bangladesh to make sure nothing was awry. And, of course, thousands of people have been killed by collapsing buildings, fires at these sweatshops in Bangladesh. And so George Mitchell goes there with another group of Council on Foreign Relations people and some other so-called independents, too, that may be people who want to get into the Council on Foreign Relations, so they better toe the line. They go there, and then they have a whitewash report that, well, everything's fine now. We've solved all the problems there in Bangladesh. So worldview that they have, neoliberal geopolitical worldview, applies in many different areas to the world scene, and not just the wars like the war in Iraq, but all these other things as well, and that I've mentioned.
I'd like to read a few things and have your input on them. This is from Jeffrey St. Clair and the late Alexander Coburn, a man who I had an enormous amount of respect for. And he founded Counterpunch.
Yeah.
This was from February 2016, but it was based upon an earlier piece. It's short. The Clintons and Colombian death squads. Quote, from 1993 to 2001, Alexander Coburn and I wrote dozens of articles on the political corruption of Bill and Hillary Clinton and their cronies in Washington, D.C. and Arkansas. In many ways, those years represented the golden age of political journalism, with a fresh scandal ripening each month. As Hillary cruises towards the Democratic nomination, if not the White House, it's time to dig into the Clinton files and resurrect the stories of sleaze, malfeasance, and transgressions from that decade. If ever there was a couple who left a sour taste in the mouth by the manner of their parting, it was surely Bill and Hillary Clinton. From time to time, against our better judgment, we tried to summon some sympathy for them, and time after time, they brusquely brought us back to earth with some bleak reminder of their all-round rottenness. Try Colombia. Less than 48 hours before Bill and Hillary quit the White House, with a legal deal covering their own ass, his administration announced that it would employ a highly questionable legal interpretation of Plan Colombia, a $1.3 billion aid package going mostly to the Colombian military. The interpretation allowed the administration to dodge entirely any certification or waiver of human rights conditions attached to the aid. The circumventing the whole certification process and providing money to the Colombian government. Now, these human rights certifications were the object of fierce lobbying by human rights groups all through the year 2000. After the certification was added, proponents of the plan tried to undermine human rights stipulations by adding the waiver option to the aid. You can argue that the experience of similar lobbying in the 1980s over aid to Central America should have instructed the groups in the folly of expecting any administration to honor such commitments, but this doesn't diminish the squalor and cynicism of what the Clinton team did in its dying hours. In August of 2000, Clinton waived four of the five human rights criteria laid out by Congress to release the first chunk of $781.5 million. A certification or waiver was also required for the second installment of $56.4 million. Two Democratic senators, Paul Wellstone and Tom Harkin, called on Clinton to reject a waiver for the second slice because the Colombian government had, quote, failed to make significant progress on human rights. But the State Department's Richard Boucher said the Clinton administration had decided that because the second slice of aid was not included in regular funds, but rather in an emergency spending bill, the certification waiver process did not apply. With virtually no opportunity for the human rights community to respond, the Clinton administration effectively created a way to avoid the whole question of human rights in Colombia. As Jack Lawn of the Colombian Support Network said bitterly, quote, "This unilateral interpretation trivializes the role of Congress in allocating funds and undermines the work of countless human rights organizations that have testified and time and again to the need to consider human rights abuses in Colombia." There's bipartisanship for you. In the deeper sense, George Bush, the elder, left office in 1993, having signed Christmas pardons for Ronald Reagan-era officials who had broken the law by breaching congressional prohibition on aid to the Nicaraguan Contras. Here we have the Clintons and Madeleine Albright doing a last-minute in-run around a modest congressional roadblock against sending U.S. dollars destined in considerable part to Colombian paramilitary death squads. One final parting shot, taken while no one was watching, just to show where they really stand, end quote. And so there is something, I'll bet not 10 people in this entire audience, which is a substantial audience, have even heard of, that Clintons were supporting the paramilitary death squads, which he killed tens of thousands in Colombia.
Yeah.
Rather interesting, considering Clinton's association with drugs and his brother and his friend Dan Lassiter, and yet he was the president who caused so many people to go to jail for long periods of time. In some cases, he was the one behind three strikes and you're out to cause people never to be able to get out of jail. Yeah. It's just one of those ironies. Now, this is another one. This is something to consider for the Council on Foreign Relations and Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. I'll just give you the beginning of it here. This is by the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights. The staggering civilian death toll in Iraq, UN report. Quote, the ISIS is responsible for countless atrocities, according to UN report. What the report fails to mention, who is behind the ISIS terrorists? Who is funding them? Who's recruiting them? What is the role of American allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Israel? In liaison with Washington, Brussels, Turkey and Saudi Arabia are involved in the training and recruitment of terrorists. Israel provides logistical support to the terrorists out of the Golan Heights. The report also fails to acknowledge the civilian deaths, which are the result of U.S.-sponsored bombing campaign initiated by the President Obama in August 2014. This is confirmed that the U.S. lead coalition is protecting the ISIS terrorists. The ISIS assassinations are targeted. Professionals, doctors, teachers, lawyers, public officials, and journalists are all targeted. Who provides them with the list of who to target, who to kill? ISIS is an intelligence asset. It has special forces within its ranks. According to the Chicago Post, and then it goes on to talk about the our support of ISIS. Now, here's what I played yesterday on my radio program, and I'm going to ask my engineer to pull up yesterday's segment where John McCain challenges the current Secretary of Defense on an issue that I think is extremely important, and that is, for over 14 months, the United States knew that upwards of 12 to 14,000 tanker trucks were going from Turkey into Syria, loading up, stealing the oil, but in ISIS-controlled areas, and then taking it back into Syria, going into a part of Iraq, stealing oil, bringing it back into Turkey, and then the president of Turkey and his family were then seeing that that was sold on the black market to countries for as little as $20 a barrel under the world price, so it was a thriving black market. So that's important that we understand that. Now, why is it that with all the intelligence we have, with all the satellite, with all the reconnaissance, with the largest amount of money spent in the world on intelligence services, that no one said, gee whiz, shouldn't we stop ISIS by stopping its $1 to $4 million a day from stolen oil by blowing up these tanker trucks? After all, these tanker trucks are not in communities. They're not near public water supplies. They're not near schools or hospitals. They're out on the highway in the desert. So you could strafe those, which, remember, we did that when Saddam Hussein was retreating from Kuwait. Remember, yeah. It was just killing everything in sight, and no one had a problem with that. And yet, we had a problem finding the trucks, and we didn't destroy a single truck. In comes Russia, and Russia destroys the trucks. And then we get angry at Russia, and John Kerry gets angry at Russia. So that is something we should think about. So we're angry at Russia for attacking our allies, our asset, ISIS. We created ISIS. And then we get angry when Russia goes after al-Nusra and al-Qaeda, because the whole purpose of these groups is to unseat Assad. And then it becomes a country that Saudi Arabia and Turkey can do whatever it wants with. And then you have another failed state. You have a failed state like you have in Libya. And look at that today. Now, I didn't see anyone from the Council on Foreign Relations or the Clintons saying, hey, look at Libya. Look what we did. I don't see anyone taking credit for it.
No.
So right. Now, so listen to this. It's only a minute, okay. 55 seconds long, because people will deny this truth. Oh, Gary, that's not true. You know, if we knew that ISIS had 12,000 trucks out on the road and was carrying oil that was financing their terrorist activities, we'd stop it. Here's John McCain, a super war hawk, and he's angry at the Secretary of the Defense. Listen to what he says.
McCain is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, by the way, but go ahead.
Here he is.
Secretary, you may want to correct the record. We all knew those fuel trucks were moving back and forth. We've seen them. We knew it. The decision was not made by the White House to attack them. I think you may want to correct the record, because I certainly knew.
Not a matter of correction at all. I can clarify if that would help. That is the case, and the air commanders were able to do was identify those trucks, and in a classified setting, I can describe exactly how that information was obtained, which were directly supporting ISIL. We have and continue to try to withhold attacks upon that part of the general infrastructure, energy, electricity, water, etc., that is also necessary for the people of Syria, and we're trying to peel off that which ISIL uses and command and controls for its own revenue source. We're now able to make that distinction, which is what enabled the airstrikes, Chairman. And with regard to where that intelligence came from and so forth, I'd be happy to have somebody come up and tell you in a classified manner.
I'll be glad to, but I repeat, we knew those fuel trucks were moving back and forth. We saw them and through ISR, and the decision was not made in the White House to attack them or not. You can't tell me they were moving all that stuff back and forth for over a year and we didn't know about it. I mean, it's just not possible given our technological capabilities, but I'll be glad to hear additional information. But I was told directly in Iraq that we didn't attack them because the decision had not been made to attack them, and they didn't want to harm anybody. So I'll be glad to call those people a liar that briefed me that were doing those attacks.
And this is a recent discussion. Did you hear about this? Was this on the news?
No, I didn't hear about it, no.
Well, wouldn't that make news if you could prove that you were the United States government, the President of the United States, Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, they were protecting these people, protecting them, arming them, funding them?
It certainly should be, but our media is not what it should be, of course. The media is very heavily influenced by these shadow government people.
And you also are aware that the Benghazi mission and the Benghazi annex in Libya were overrun, not because of a film, but because that's where ammunition was going from the annex into Syria. And so if the truth came out that Hillary Clinton was fully apprised and aware that the CIA annex in Libya was used for arming terrorists, they'll claim, well, these were moderate freedom fighters. Didn't we hear moderate freedom fighters when it came to Ronald Reagan's Contras?
Yeah, that's right. We heard about that.
Yeah. Now, this is a separate one. This is, there's one other here. The Five Lamest Excuses for Hillary Clinton's Vote to Invade Iraq by Stephen Zunes of Foreign Policy and Focus. Quote, Clinton supporters want Democratic voters to forgive their candidate's support for the most disastrous foreign policy decisions in decades. They should not. Former Senator and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is the only candidate for the 2016 Democratic presidential nominations who supported the invasion of Iraq. That war not only resulted in 4,500 American soldiers being killed and tens of thousands more permanently disabled, but also hundreds of thousands of Iraqi deaths, and the destabilization of the region with the rise of Islamic State and other extremists, and a dramatic increase in the federal deficit, resulting in the major cutbacks to important social programs. Moreover, the primary reason Clinton gave for supporting President George Bush's request for authorization that illegal and unnecessary war have long been proven false. As a result, many Democratic voters are questioning, despite her years of foreign policy experience, whether Clinton has the judgment and integrity to lead the United States on the world stage. It was just such concerns that resulted in her losing 2008 nomination to then-Senator Barack Obama, an outspoken Iraqi war opponent. This time around, Clinton supporters have been hoping that enough Democratic voters, the overwhelming majority of whom oppose the war, will forget about her strong endorsement of the Bush administration's most disastrous foreign policy. Failing that, they've come up with a number of excuses to justify her October 2002 vote for the authorization of military force. Here they are, in no particular order. Quote, Hillary Clinton's vote wasn't for war, but simply to pressure Saddam Hussein to allow weapons inspectors back into Iraq, end quote. Wrong. At the time of the vote, Saddam Hussein had already agreed in principle to a return of weapons inspectors. His government was negotiating with the United Nations Monitoring and Verification Commission on the details, which were formally institutionalized a few weeks later. Indeed, it would have been resolved earlier had the United States not repeatedly postponed a UN Security Council resolution in the hopes of inserting language that would have allowed Washington to unilaterally interpret the level of compliance. Furthermore, If then-Senator Clinton's desire was simply to push Saddam into complying with the inspection process, she wouldn't have voted against the substitute Levin Amendment, which would have also granted President Bush authority to use force, but only if Iraq defied subsequent UN demands regarding the inspections process. Instead, Hillary Clinton voted for a Republican-sponsored resolution to give Bush the authority to invade Iraq at the time and circumstance of his own choosing. In fact, unfettered large-scale weapons inspections had been going on in Iraq for nearly 4 months at the time the Bush administration launched the March 2003 invasion, despite the UN weapons inspectors having not found any evidence whatsoever of weapons of mass destruction or active weapons of mass destruction programs after months of searching. Clinton made clear that the United States should invade Iraq anyway. Indeed, she asserted that even though Saddam was in full compliance with UN Security Council, he nevertheless needed to resign as president, leave the country, and allow the U.S. troops to occupy the country. Quote, "The president gave Saddam Hussein one last chance to avoid war," Clinton said in a statement, "and the world hopes that Saddam Hussein will finally hear this ultimatum, understand the severity of his words, and act accordingly." When Saddam refused to resign and the Bush administration launched the invasion, Clinton went on the record calling for unequivocal support, in quote, of Bush's, quote, "firm leadership and decisive actions as part of ongoing global war on terrorism," end quote. Well, how did that unequivocal support for Bush's, quote, "firm leadership and decision-making" work out there?
It didn't work
Hillary,
out so good.
Bill?
Yeah.
Tag
yeah,
team?
Right.
All right, how'd that work out?
How'd that work out?
Yeah.
Well, it's because Hillary and Bill both, follow the instructions from the Council on Foreign Relations people, who are in their administration, of course, in Bill's administration, and Hillary's advisors are almost all top advisors are these Council on Foreign Relations people. And I have a quote from Hillary, which I think is shows how close she is to the Council on Foreign Relations and how close she follows their views. I got it off the Council on Foreign Relations' own website. When the Council on Foreign Relations set up a headquarters in Washington, D.C. They've had a headquarters in New York since 1921, but they had an office in Washington, D.C. for many years, but they decided to have a dual headquarters, and they set up a new headquarters in Washington, D.C., and they invited, this was in July of 2009, they invited Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to come and speak there. And she said this at the beginning of her speech. "It's good to have," this is a quote, it's from Hillary Clinton, "It's good to have an outpost of the council right here down the street from the State Department. We get a lot of advice from the council, so this will mean I won't have as far to go to be told what we should be doing and how we should think about the future," end quote. So they just, Hillary, there's a quote from Hillary, just listens to whatever the Council on Foreign Relations says. Says, "We get a lot of advice from the council, and now it's right down the street from the State Department. I can go down and get the advice anytime I want. They'll tell us what we should be doing and what we should be thinking." So that's right from the horse's mouth there from Hillary Clinton. That's where they get their instructions. And it's through the advisors, of course, but also directly. Hillary Clinton has spoken more than 10 times in recent years at the Council on Foreign Relations. Even though she's not a member, it's interesting to note she's not a member, but Chelsea Clinton is a member. And, of course, it's been mentioned several times that Goldman Sachs has been a longtime Clinton sponsor. That's just one of the big Wall Street firms, of course. But the Clintons do have a close relationship with Goldman Sachs. When I mentioned Chelsea Clinton, who has become a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in the last few years, her husband worked for Goldman Sachs. Chelsea Clinton's husband worked for Goldman Sachs for a number of years and then went out becoming a hedge fund operator. And he got a lot of his initial capital from Goldman Sachs people, including the chairman, Lloyd Blankenfeld, gave him a lot of money to start up his hedge fund. So that's Chelsea Clinton's husband. So they have a long connection with Wall Street and Goldman Sachs.
I just want to finish our program with two short reads. This is from Salon.com, and, quote, "It may be a generational thing. I was born in 1967, but this is what Hillary and Bill Clinton will always mean to me. Sister Soldier, Ricky Ray Rector, welfare reform, and the crime bill. And beyond, really, behind all of that, the desperate desire to win over white voters by declaring to the American electorate, we are not the party of Jesse Jackson. We are not the Rainbow Coalition. Many of the liberal journalists who are supporting Hillary Clinton's candidacy are too young to remember what the Clintons did to the American politics and the Democratic Party in the 1990s. But even journalists who are old enough seem to have forgotten just how much the Clintons' national ascendancy was premised on the repudiation of the black voters and black interest. This was a move that was both inspired and applauded by a small but influential group of Beltway journalists and party strategists who believed making the Democrats a white middle-class party was the only path back to the White House after wandering for 12 years in the Republican wilderness. But for me, it's as vivid as yesterday. I still remember Clinton pollster Stanley Greenberg's American Prospect article, which claimed that the Democrats were, quote, too identified with minorities and special interests to speak for average Americans. Black people are not being average Americans, you see. The article, American Prospect co-editor Paul Starr proudly proclaimed last year, quote, is widely recognized for its influence on Bill Clinton's presidential campaign. In 1992, Starr incidentally just penned a defense of Politico of Hillary Clinton as the only serious Democratic candidate. So something that African-American supporters should understand. And also, I do not have time in this program, but I will on an up one. When Hillary Clinton says, but my husband, you know, he left America prosperous. Robert Pollan has something from The Nation magazine that challenges that. And in fact, the Clintonomics was a disaster for most Americans. Under Bill Clinton, Wall Street created a ruinous bubble while workers lost wages and power. More on that in an upcoming program. I want to thank you very much for being with us today and sharing your insights.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be on your show.
Professor Lawrence Shoup, S-H-O-U-P. He is a historian who's been researching the background agendas of the Council on Foreign Relations for 40 years. He's taught history, social science, and international relations at the University of Illinois, as well as San Francisco State University. And for 50 years, he's been active in human rights struggles, protesting Vietnam War, marching with Martin Luther King, participated in the union movement, holds degrees from California State University and a doctorate at Northwestern. And his website is lawrenceshoup.com. And his book is Wall Street's Think Tank. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you for listening.